I probably should do a little biographical background. I was born in the baptized into the Augustana Lutheran Church, Omaha, Nebraska, a few years back, a few years ago. And my family, my parents and brothers, most of them live in around Portland, Oregon now. And I teach at the in the University of California in Santa Barbara, where I've been for 12 years after doing graduate work at Yale and completing seminary work at Augustana and Rock Island, and also at Pacific Lutheran Seminary in Berkeley, where I still serve on the board. And I haven't been up here for a long time. I was at Holden Village one time, well, just for two nights about 5 years ago for a pastor's conference. And I really wanted to be able to bring the family here, so we've come all this way to be here this week and are enjoying it. What I get paid to do at the university is not what you want to hear about, but it's something I'm really interested in. And I teach most of the courses there in the area of contemporary trends in religion. So we're spending our time, there are 13 of us on the faculty, and we spend a lot of our time just trying to understand what is happening in the world of religion these days, what changes have come about. We also try to figure out why the changes have come, where things are going. We're interested in such things as who is taking the lead, because I think all of us would agree that things do change in religion, and that's one of the questions that we haven't answered at all, is why does religion change? Why do the styles change, the attitudes, the behavior, liturgies, trends? Why are there always new trends in the area of religion, and there are even new trends in the area of theology? And we're not quite sure why that is, but we think we know how to chart change and how to trace the changes that are occurring. So what I had in mind to talk about tonight. Oh, not to talk at you, but to give a little bit, enough of a background so that you know what my subject is, so that we can discuss this together, are some of the changes that have occurred during the past decade. And they've been very profound changes. And I'd like to do this in terms of a number of anecdotes or stories, which I think illustrate sort of the state of things at a particular point in that decade. And then I'll tell some other stories that are more recent stories, which I think typify some of the changes that have occurred more recently. And I'm going back really a decade, and I really mean I can date this thing fairly accurately. The book, The Theology of Hope, was first published in Germany in 1965. And that was a great epoch-making book, which set the stage for many of the things that were to happen from that point forward. But I'm not going to talk about the book. I'd rather talk about tendencies or moods or aspirations. And the first one can be the first one is a story that I first heard from Rabbi Emil Fackenheim, who said it was an Hasidic tale, and it's a story of a rabbi who thought that he knew the exact time and place where the Messiah was to come. We would say return, but he said the Messiah was to appear. And he'd calculated this thing so carefully that he went to Jerusalem, booked a room in a hotel, because he thought he knew the exact time that the Messiah was to come. And he just waited there for the Messiah. And he wasn't there very many days before something happened. One night, as he was sleeping, right before dawn, which was the time that he expected the Messiah to come, he heard these trumpets blasting from the direction of the Mount of Olives. So he thought, surely today is the day, because all the predictions were accurate, and even the trumpet sounds, even coming from the right direction. So he went to the window of his hotel and lifted up the shade and looked out, and the first thing that he saw was a donkey driver beating his donkey. So he put the shade back down, and he said, surely if donkey drivers are beating donkeys, the Messiah has not yet come. And he went away, you know, disappointed. Now, I tell that story because that story is pretty typical of a theological trend or a religious move or mood that was prevalent in the middle 60s. And that mood was captured by the theology of hope. And the idea was that if there's no salvation, if there's no salvation for all of us, there's no salvation for any one of us. That is, if donkey drivers are beating donkeys, if people are poor and hungry, if there's economic inequality throughout the world, hunger throughout the world, racial injustice, social injustice, ethnic injustice, all of these things, then it's very, very difficult to talk about salvation. And that mood was captured in the movement called the Theology of Hope, which had as its goal the kind of transformation of salvation from private, personal terms into corporate terms. And Jürgen Moltmann, who will be speaking over in Seattle on Sunday, is the leader of this kind of Theology of Hope movement, who the author of the book, The Theology of Hope, said that that salvation pertains to the coming of the kingdom of God. And if there's any one theme in the New Testament that is essential to the gospel, it's the theme of the kingdom of God. In fact, he developed a kind of formula for talking about this, and the sentence or the statement would be, or the question would be, what is it without which the gospel would not be what it is? And the answer to that was, or what is it without which the New Testament would not be what it is? And the answer to both questions is the kingdom of God. If you leave out the emphasis on the kingdom of God, the New Testament is just simply not New Testament. That the kingdom of God is the core of the New Testament according to that movement. And if that element is left absent or unattended, salvation becomes understood in personal or individual terms, and then it's not salvation. Then you can't talk easily about God loving the world. Rather, it's God loves this individual, that individual, and another individual. But the fullness of the gospel message is not there. Well, I think that was a movement or a tendency that hit with tremendous force in the middle 60s. Now, in kind of technical terms, we refer to that as the revival of the social gospel in America. And there were signs of it in all the churches, not right in the 60s, but before very long, corporate salvation. And it took form in protest movements, in people gathering behind various programs. And we still have it, concern for the hungry, for the poor. And it isn't just as it was in the old days, a kind of the way we would express our gratitude to God for loving us is by caring for our neighbor. It was much more radical than that. It was the idea that, really the conviction, that unless the gospel translated into those terms, it wasn't truly gospel. And there was no satisfaction in knowing that you felt all right inside about your relationship with God if the world was that way. If there are hungry people, poor people, if the injustices were so rank and manifest as they were. And the fires of that movement were really fanned by the Vietnam War. All of the injustices that were being focused on really could be concentrated on the Vietnam War. And following that was a student protest and all sorts of protests, well, not only in this country but all around the world, which was very much in keeping with the beginning of the counterculture. I think the Theology of Hope was the kind of Christian form of the Christian expression of a counterculture, and it made perfect sense for that movement to take fire, a root, at that particular time. And I think the key book of that movement is Moltmann's book, The Theology of Hope. Well, I want to get just talking about theology here, but I want to continue telling these stories because I have kind of a chronicle to trace. The next is kind of a story that comes in that sequence is somewhat autobiographical. I graduated from the seminary in 1960, And in my graduating class was a very gifted man, Ralph Peterson, who is now a pastor of St. Peter's Lutheran Church in Manhattan. And he's doing wonderful things there and is making a kind of home within the city. I don't know how many of you know St. Peter's Lutheran Church, but it's one of the really encouraging positive signs in New York City. And I make a point of trying to meet with Ralph periodically, and we usually waste little time when we're together. I don't see him very often, and his time is he doesn't have that much free time, and so we talk about meaningful things immediately or very shortly after we get together. And this was, I think, in 1968 when I was trying to tell him about the theology of hope, and we were talking about that, and he gave me the example of his kind of dilemma or consternation as a pastor in this downtown Manhattan. And he told it in terms of a story, and I think that's the way to do it. If you can get it in terms of a story, then I think you understand it better than if it's abstract and theoretical and conceptual and so forth. And he said it's an account of what happened in his church one Sunday morning when he was standing up in the pulpit preaching and at the early service, 8 o'clock service, and he noticed this, whom he referred to as a rather disheveled young woman, come into the church, and I don't know how old a disheveled young woman would be, but I placed her in her kind of middle 20s, maybe. I mean, it's a guess. I suppose you could have disheveled young women who are middle 30s, but and the story was that she had she sat there for a while and listened to him preach, and then as he was kind of coming to the conclusion of all this, she walked out. But on walking out, and not with great protest, but just left the church. And as she was walking out, she left a little card, a piece of paper with the usher. Well, he found out later something about her story. She had come to New York City from someplace in the Midwest, and in search of, as he said, fame and fortune, like so many people going to New York City or Los Angeles or San Francisco or a lot of places. And she thought she was a dancer, I think, or knew something about music, and because somebody along the way had told her that she had wonderful talent, which is an awful thing to lay on people, unless it's really true. And things hadn't gone well, and she didn't get the kind of job she wanted, and she ended up doing something that was beneath her dignity, and went from one thing to the next, and had gotten in with a group of so-called friends who were not really her supporters, and. Her life really degenerated there, quickly and deeply. And the night before she had come into the church, on that Saturday night, which would be early Sunday morning, she had gone to some kind of party. Now, he didn't give me any of the details. I don't know if he knows them. Some orgiastic thing that was occurring. And she stood there, or sat there, whatever, and watched as somebody died. One of her friends died right kind of on the floor in front of her. And that was kind of the end of the thing for her. And she wandered through the streets of New York City until she walked into this church, maybe one of the first kind of friendly open doors on Sunday morning. And she sat there for a while, as I said, listened to most of that sermon, then got up and walked out, and left her name with the usher. But on the slip of paper on which she left her name was the statement, "I'm searching for a mystery that I can trust. I'm searching for a mystery that I can trust." And Ralph said that really bothered him. I mean, bothered him very, very much, because he had chosen that day to talk about public housing. Now, that was a dilemma, because it made perfect sense in 1968 or in any of those years, even now, to talk about public housing. I mean, it makes perfect sense to talk about public housing in downtown Manhattan or New York City or in any large metropolitan area. At the same time, if you're talking about public housing, and there's somebody in the group who's looking for a mystery that she or he can trust, it doesn't quite meet the demand or the interest very well. And he said he didn't know what to do about that. He didn't think he could interpret public housing. He couldn't construe public housing as the mystery that could be trusted. On the other hand, he couldn't abandon the interest in public housing because there were people there who needed to know something about mysteries they could trust. So he asked the question, how do you do it? Do you public housing one Sunday, the next Sunday work on mysteries, or take public housing, have a public housing month, And then in February, you do something on something a little richer or more personal? Or do you kind of mix it up, talk 20 minutes, 10 minutes on public housing, 10 minutes on something? Well, he didn't know how to do that. And he said that was a dilemma. He had become a follower of the theology of hope. And he had learned its slogans and its lessons, that there's no salvation for any one individual unless there's somehow there's salvation for the race or for humankind or for society, for culture, unless the very context in which people live is transformed. And at the same time, here was a person with a precious individual need to whom he was not speaking at all, to whom the church was not speaking that Sunday, because he was concentrating on one of the key themes in the theology of hope. Well, I wrote to my friend Moltmann about that at the time, and didn't get a very satisfactory answer, and learned that he went through the same kind of trouble at about the same time, that in the beginning of that movement he was very, very enthusiastic about the theology of hope, social gospel, political theology, social protest, seeing the church as an instrument which challenges the status quo, which, as Johannes Metz, one of his Moltmann's kind of brothers in the faith, said that the church is there to keep things moving, keep things free, to always ask the question of meaning about the institutions of society. He Moltmann and a lot of us were kind of strong supporters of that point of view. And I think for some of us, he particularly, I don't know if I did it as much, some of us almost became revolutionaries. You listen to things in churches and you think, they're just not up to date. This is outdated already. It's obsolete. It's the old way of thinking. It's the kind of statements that are being made outside of this kind of social, political awareness. The kind of corporate conscience isn't regulating statements of that kind. And then there was that sort of crisis that occurred not very many years after that, when it also became clear that the individual couldn't be overlooked. Now I'm still going autobiographically, but I'm in a very happy position in many ways, in that I'm a school teacher, and I spend my time teaching about all these things, and I sort of think that I can't teach them unless I know them from the inside. And that includes Zen Buddhism and all the things that I end up talking about in the classroom. And I don't experiment with all of them to the degree that I experimented with this one, but this one really, this theology of hope, really sort of captured my enthusiasm and my interest, my devotion. So I knew what it felt like. I mean, I knew kind of from the inside how that set of convictions could regulate one's life. And at about the same time, it became very clear to me that kind of sense of interior calm just was kind of gone. I mean, it was frenzy, not quite frenzy, but very close to frenzy instead. You know, reading the newspapers all the time, wondering how these issues were going to be settled in this part of the world and another part of the world. And one gets to the point where the sort of confidence of faith becomes dependent upon success in the social and political arena. If there are kind of sort of positive movements forward, like if students are successful in bringing about reform, then you can feel rather good about what has been happening. But there are tremendous disappointments that come along the way, and I think in the main, that whole movement has led to disappointment. I don't think it was successful. I mean, it was less successful than more successful. And there are some gains, but there are also a lot of kind of rear guard action and a lot of lack of success, and that kind of that hold on interior freedom or interior peace or tranquility, it was impossible for me to maintain that in the situation that was occurring at that particular time. Now, I want to move on to this 10-year period, and I'm going a little slower than I anticipated, so I'll speed it up a little bit, because I've only done 3 of the 10 years. We still have kind of 7 to go, and really you can't date the things quite that accurately. But I don't know quite if it was the McGovern campaign of 1972, or what happened to the counterculture in the 70s. I liked the counterculture tremendously, and I And I thought that the new music, the new poetry, the new literature, all of this, and even the demand for reform in education, reform in society, all of that was for the good. But it got out of hand, and it was put down by, well, there was too much of it. The strategies were not worked out very carefully. There was lack of patience. The thing became too radical and too overt and really violent rather than nonviolent. And there was a kind of, you know, the expected reaction to all of that, which occurred sometime in the early 70s, and it occurred in churches, in schools, in society, in culture, really everywhere. We didn't have the language to talk about that, about what was happening, until there was an article by a psychologist at Yale University, James Dittes, D-I-T-T-E-S, who was also a ordained congregational minister, who wrote a very kind of brief essay on positive disengagement. And the idea in this essay on positive disengagement was that positive disengagement is the proper terminology to describe the mood of the early 70s. And Dittes opens this kind of argument with reference to a book by Kenneth Keniston, which some of you have read, called The Uncommitted. And in that book, The Uncommitted, Keniston says that the youth of the land are uncommitted because there is nothing large enough to which they can commit themselves. No ultimate concern, no great cause that will really kind of hold their devotion without qualification. That's oftentimes the way religious people talk about young people, that, you know, they haven't found their God yet, and they're going chasing around for all these other things that are less than God, and they're going to be disappointed because they haven't found the true God. Well, Dittes says it kind of looks that way. It looks as though they are uncommitted because there's nothing that they have found yet which will hold their commitment. But Dittes says it isn't that. He is no longer convinced that that's the way things are with young people. And all of us, I think, spend our time with young people because they're sort of bellwethers. It seems to be that in most cases they get to the future before the rest of us do. And if you study that, you can understand. I mean, the access to the future is much surer and quicker, much more reliable. Dittes' conclusion is that it's a different kind of uncommitment. It's a deliberate, he says, a deliberate attempt to be uncommitted. That is, it's a deliberate attempt to disengage, but without feeling guilty about it. And he says it's a profound thing that is occurring in religious circles, because all of the language that we have developed to talk about faith is of the other kind. It's active, it's tremendously active, and it's overwhelmingly positive. And the language we use simply indicates that. We don't talk about being uncommitted, but we talk about being committed. We don't talk about disengaging, but we talk about being involved, you know, being involved in the work of the church or in the cause. It's always involvement, commitment, engagement, in words which are active and sort of positive at the same time. And then we wonder, or we did, we wonder about somebody who is no longer engaged. We say, well, there must be something wrong there. He or she is kind of going back on his original fervor, or the energy's gone, or maybe they're just tired or something. But we don't wonder about people who are really really committed. I mean, because commitment is good and non-commitment is bad. That's the way it used to be. Now, Dittes says what the young people are doing is trying to reverse that. They're trying to find a positive way of being uncommitted. And they call that, or he calls it, positive disengagement. That is a way of pulling back without feeling guilty about pulling back. Disengaging and feeling good about, I mean, knowing that it's necessary to disengage. And not just the way many of us do that. You know, we disengage because, well, we say we have too many things now. We have to cut down a little bit, or we have to watch our health, or very much like the way we treat holidays or vacation times, is the time to sort of get rested up so you can work again. And uncommitment could go that way. You could pull back for a time because, at least for the time being, you're not able to do any more. Dittes says, no, it's not that. It's It's disengagement, it's withdrawal, but it's not really retreat, it's not escapism. But it's an attempt to step outside the stream of things, at least temporarily, in order to get a kind of different look, a different perspective on what is happening. Because when the individual was so kind of totally engaged in the process, perspective and insight just weren't there. You get so close to the subject that you really can't see what to do about it. You become, well, and of course that's the great lesson of that whole thing, is that a lot of people got into the thing and tried to transform it and discover that they were as much of the problem as they were the solution. And you really, I mean, you can't do very much about something that where the problem is you yourself. Now, I didn't know, Didis didn't have that language down very well, but it just struck me at the time that that's what I saw our students doing, and that's what I saw myself doing. Disengaging, but disengaging not as something negative, but as something which had as its purpose the development of a kind of alternative way of being, a different way of being than sort of social, political, involved, committed, engaged. And I didn't know quite what to do with that, except I started looking around to see if we could find examples of disengagement, of religious disengagement, or disengagement which is sanctioned in religious terms. Well, it's somewhat coincidental, but it was also by design, that at the same time I became very interested in the life of the monasteries, because it seemed to me that that's what had been happening there all these years, a kind of disengagement from the sort of regular way of living and being in order to develop an alternative kind of religious strategy. And my first, I hadn't been in monasteries very much before. I'd been in a few around the Midwest, didn't enjoy it very much. I went in there with tremendous biases. I was thinking that, as I still do think from time to time, and it's partly true, that a lot of those monks just couldn't handle things the way us normal people, we normal people handle things, so they have to go off like that, live that way. But the first real exposure to monastic life was in our city of Santa Barbara at a monastery which is, I guess, only about 4 blocks from our house. And I passed this thing every day on the way to work. I really never bothered to look inside. It's a, well, I guess it's because a female monastery, a convent, but it's called a monastery, the Monastery of the Poor Clares. And because we were studying in one of my classes, studying medieval religion at the time, and we had been thinking about St. Francis of Assisi, and this is the Poor Clares, who was named after Clare, who was the friend of Francis. It made good sense for us to go visit that monastery as a class. So I invited the members of the class, all of those who wanted to go with me to this monastery of the Poor Clares, and we didn't know what to expect. I called up the lady, and she said, This is Mother Clare. And I really didn't know what to do next. I was prepared to call her sister, but to call her mother was a little difficult, because I had a mother, I still do, and she's the only one I call mother, kind of. Anyway, we made this appointment, went over there at 2 o'clock, and on an afternoon there were about 12 of us. I've written all this down in a little book I published recently called Hope Against Hope, which is published by Fortress Press. I give this account in the middle of it. And because I've already written down this now, I can't remember it all that well, because it's now committed to the pages. But we went into this room, and it was an odd kind of room. It was someplace in the middle of the building. There's a room about 12 by 12, and there were about 12 of us, and there were chairs in there, but they weren't arranged in any particular order. They were sort of around the edges, and it was clear that somebody had provided enough chairs for us to sit down in, but they didn't tell us how to arrange the chairs. And all of us had come about 10 minutes early to this place and had stopped out in front so that we could, we didn't want to embarrass ourselves by coming late. We also wanted to agree on certain rules of protocol when we got in there so we wouldn't embarrass ourselves or the class or the University of California or particularly the instructor of the class. And we decided that we would certainly try to sit in the right direction when we got in this room. But we couldn't tell how to do that. There was no altar in there. But there was a kind of crucifix up on a fireplace thing, but that didn't look like an altar, and so we didn't think we had to face in that direction. And nobody could remember which way was east. You can always face east and you're all right. But we had gone down so many hallways that we couldn't get that one going. What I can remember about this as we were trying to decide how to sit properly, was I remember just kind of seeing out the side of my eye this little kind of metal grating in the wall, like a grill. And there was a curtain behind it, or a shade, some kind. It was covered over, but I could see this thing. And my first thought was, I remember that Union Pacific Railroad station out in Grand Island, Nebraska, where my father worked for the railroad, and I had this train pass. I used to travel around quite a bit, particularly the year before I got married. And I remember going to that thing and seeing this grill work and thinking, that's just like they do in the post offices or Union Pacific, in those train depots. And then I thought, now that's what I'm going to remember, because why should there be a grill here? That's kind of supported my bias. And then I thought, now that's what I'm going to remember, because why should there be a grill here? That's kind of supported my bias. If you had to have grills on windows, that means either you're trying to keep somebody in or you're trying to keep somebody out, and that shows that this is an institution which is somewhat far from being free. Well, before we got it sorted out, this shade went up, and we heard this laughter, all these kind of lady giggles from the other room. And there must have been 20 sisters who had been sitting back in that room, I suppose, the whole time. To this day, don't know what they were doing there. I imagine they're praying, like we had gathered together 10 minutes early to get our signals straight. They probably were deep in prayer back there quietly, so they would be prepared to talk to us properly. And here, from behind that grating, which was so thick you could hardly see anybody behind it, came the voice, I am Mother Claire. And she said, can we be on a first name basis? And I said, that's fine with us. So we all introduced ourselves, but we couldn't see any of them, and they could hardly see us. You could see Mother Claire there sitting at the window. So I went to the window right opposite Mother Claire, as though I were the spokesman for our group. She was the spokesman for her group. And it was, for about 30 minutes, a real disaster. I was preoccupied with that laughter that I kept hearing. I didn't know why. I couldn't anticipate when those ladies would laugh. You know, almost anything we would say would get giggles from their side, and we weren't really saying all that much. Except we did ask some rather odd questions. One of the students on whom I can always depend, he said, if I were to join this place, could I bring my phonograph record? Well, she said that you could bring your phonograph records, but you'd have to share them with the rest of us because we have no individual property here. It's all corporate. But she said, but there's a larger difficulty, larger obstacle. And he fell for it. He said, and what's that? And she said, well, you're a man. As though he'd forgotten that. But it's ludicrous to think that some man would walk up there with his phonograph record and ask if he could join. Well, the whole kind of hour was going that way. And then somebody asked him if they ever got out of that place. And then with a lot of laugh, following this, what I call in the book, I'm getting criticized for this because it looks like a little bit of being sacrilegious, corporate convent mirth, those background giggles. The lady said, well, yeah, Mother Claire said, we do get out on occasion. We were out this week. And they went out to vote. This was during the time of the California primary. They went out to vote. Then one of our reliable students said, and I imagine you voted in blocks, in block. And then, of course, there's something all voting for the same person kind of. I mean, all walking down like penguins, you know, walking down the street, feeling they're all voting for the same candidate. And then there's a little bit of laughter on that. And lots of questions about, you know, how do you know? The questions really were, what are a bunch of nice ladies like you doing in a place like this? But it was never quite like that. It was just questions like, do you ever read the newspaper? And following the giggles, the answer was, yes, we do on occasion. Then the question was, do you read church papers? And then they said they read the Christian Science Monitor, but they don't touch any more the National Catholic Reporter. And then we got more, being a group dynamics man myself, I realized that the conversation was beginning to break down. Well, after we talked about television and how they're supported and how they find out what's going on in the world, this Mother Mary Claire, Mother Claire said, because the hour's about over, she said, it's very clear to me that you don't understand. And we didn't understand. And she said, we understand ourselves to be living at the very center of the universe. And said, nothing happens at the edges or on the periphery which doesn't eventually reflect back to the center. But she only said that once, and that there was complete silence on our part. My thought was that I'd gone by that place all these many years, about 10, 11 years already. I certainly didn't know that was the center of the universe. And I didn't know that everything that happened everywhere in the universe somehow reflected there. So that was the first thought, but the second thought was really that more profound thought that great historian of religion at the University of Chicago, Mercy Eliade, says that all religion revolves around a sense of time and a sense of space, sacred space. And every person in every religion, there's some kind of consciousness regarding the center, you know, where the center is. And it's not just a kind of personal center, but it's a center of the world for that person. It may be home, or it may be the church sanctuary, or the holy of holies. But it's a space that is set aside, which is unlike all other spaces. And that space or that location has the quality of sacredness about it. It's also absolute. I mean, it isn't just, this is my little space and that's your space, but it has a characteristic of being kind of final and unqualified and unconditioned. And she was saying that about that little, those 2 acres on the corner of Garden and Los Olivos streets the small kind of city of Santa Barbara. Well, that was enough to get me hooked on the subject, because I began to, because I know something about the thing anyway, I began to realize that the monasteries, the monastic life in the Western world was the first counterculture in the West. It was when the Roman Empire was really breaking down and degenerating. Prior to the time of St. Augustine, before the early Middle Ages, but in the last days of that Roman civilization, that St. Anthony, the first Christian monk, went away from the whole thing. He didn't know how to do it. I mean, he could never recommend that the monastic life, that the way he was developing the monastic life, that he was setting down a pattern for all Christians to follow. Certainly nothing like that. All he knew, as I read it, is that he had to find an alternative. There had to be another way of living than living in the cities in that kind of civilization. He developed, along with a lot of other people, developed monastic life. Well, the next stage in that in the development of medieval monasticism is sort of championed by Saint Benedict, for whom the Benedictines are named, who carried the monastic ideal far beyond the aspirations of Anthony. For Anthony, it was simply an alternative to the established way of being in a decadent society. For Benedict, the monasteries became the institutions through which classical culture was transmitted into the Christian West. We all know that now. The monasteries that became the places where the manuscripts were copied and passed on. They were the places where music was kept, where really they became the kind of custodians of ancient culture and the transmitters of ancient culture. When everything else failed, the monasteries were carried on that role and had that capacity. And it began, if you want to project forward, you can make kind of parallel applications to our own time. And there's nothing more significant in the religious world right now than the interaction of currents from East and West, from Asia and Europe, from Asian religions and Western religions. And the place where those currents are being sorted out and synthesized and understood and kind of redefined more profoundly, more deliberately, with more skill than anywhere else, is in monastic life in America, or not only in America, but throughout the world, in the monasteries in Asia, Europe, North America, everywhere. And in the monasteries that I've been looking at, in very many of them, Christian monasteries, they'll have the regular chapel for worship, but they'll also have the zendo, the zen room, where the Christian monks, like a place up down in Oregon, at Lafayette, Oregon, the Trappist Abbey, the abbot of the abbey meets with four of the junior members of the monastery, who are the youngest ones, who have just come out of college, every morning from 2 a.m. to 4 a.m. for zen rites, or zen practices. And they still get up at 5:30 for the regular practices, the regular Christian worship, which goes on there throughout the day. I'm about ready to wind this up because I'm up to the present time. I think right now among students, maybe that's all I'm talking about here. I don't think it's quite come into the churches yet, although it's there in a way too. There's a large interest in recovering what is called the contemplative tradition, the revival of prayer, meditation, asceticism. We have examples of that here right in Holden Village in the way we eat, the menu, which is, I'm sure I haven't been here that many times, but I'm sure it's different now than what it was some years back. There's a great sensitivity about to the needs of the body, the way in which the spirit is dependent upon the body. Great interest in the rhythms of the human heart. Interiority is the word that is most often used for that, or spirituality. And I don't think it's... I don't want to give the impression that I've been in on this all the time, because I think it is really very, very new. But there are very, very close ties between the interest, that kind of interest, which is just really coming to the fore at the present time, and the interests of those 19th, early 20th century Scandinavian pietists like Rosenius and Hauge. Halsby lived in the 20th century, but I checked that out one night. It was kind of a little bit terrifying. I thought I'd discovered something rather brand new here, and then I went back into an old devotional book that my mother had gotten from her grandmother, in which she had left some messages. My mother had written some notes for me, which she thought I would one day discover. Of course, I discovered them now while she's still alive. But I found that the table of contents of this devotional book by this man Rosenius, who wrote in the mid-19th century in Sweden, was very, very much like some of the kind of sequence of subjects that is dealt with in these kind of manuals of mystical religion from the Middle Ages. And I don't think it was conscious on Rosenius's part. I don't think he knew enough about all that to be able to do it deliberately. But it just shows that the way that many of you, I suppose, were trained, I mean, the backgrounds that many of you have, that I have in a way, is more like what is happening at the present time than we would have guessed, I think. But it has become a crisis, or it will become a crisis, within the churches. It's a crisis between action and contemplation. And those are different dispositions. The one involves, activity, involvement, commitment, all those rah-rah words. And the other is withdrawal and turning within. And I don't know where that takes us, except that I think it brings us up to the moment. I don't know if I'll have another time to talk while I'm here at Holden Village, but I can say more about, you know, what goes on within those monasteries. And what I wanted to do tonight is simply kind of give a sort of the background for the interest that I have in the subject. And I don't think it's simply a kind of personal quirk or individual, an odd, strange interest on my part, but I think it's somehow in keeping with the tendency of things, not only in the churches, but in, we can say, in terms of religious consciousness more widely. Well, there's still any time. Does anyone want to comment on that? Or yes?
I was just going to mention, for people who are more interested in what you're saying, my husband and I went to a Benedictine monastery for a while, and after that, obviously neither of us called that, but we went to Washington, D.C., and in Washington, D.C., now this may be prevalent in more areas, it's just what I was familiar with, there is a church called Church of the Savior in D.C., and that's the only example I know of yet, I may be ignorant on this, where there really is a good combination of what they call the journey inward, the journey outward. And the journey inward is, you know, what you've been talking about tonight, about the contemplation. Mm-hmm. And it includes a time of, when you become a member of the church, you take three vows. And one is to every day have a time of contemplation, which involves silence, and which also involves keeping a spiritual diary, and the spiritual diary being the second. And the third is the vow to the journey outward, which is being part of a mission group in the church, which depends on whatever your gifts are, and can include anything from coffee house to foster care to renovating old buildings, you know, depending on where your gifts are. But we went with the church to a retreat, and it was a silent retreat. And for the whole weekend, we didn't talk at all. And I had never been to anything like this, but I was a little prepared for it because of having been at the monastery. And one thought I had all, you know, as I started was, will silence have anything to do with action? I couldn't coordinate it at all. And how does contemplation, you know, work into activity? And I really realized from that weekend that it is that honest kind of retreat, it's that silence that gives us the momentum, the strength, and the wisdom. I think this is what you were saying about so much of the 60s when, you know, we're busy demonstrating, wasn't based on wisdom. Not that it wasn't correct, but I don't think we always knew really what we were doing or what we really believed, whereas this gives you the time for real reflection and meditation, for seeking God's will through silence. And, you know, it was an amazing strength for me. And that, you may just be interested, someone here may be interested in reading about a church like that, which is working on combining those two things of action and contemplation, getting up to the present.
Yeah. I think that really is the great interest of the present, is to try to find a way to put the two together. There's one thing I fear, I mean, I'm a little bit critical of in that. I don't know how much of this, the stress on action, is just plain old American pragmatism. You know, the thing is, if it works, it's real. And I would rather allow a little more time to pass before we try to get these two things to coalesce. I mean, I wish there were opportunity for us to learn both rhythms, both moods, a little better. For example, you mentioned silence. I used to think silence was sort of nothing, like empty. It's amazing how full silence is of content. And I've gone on with that thought to think about why Luther would ever say, faith comes by hearing. Why would that be such a great thing to him? Fides ex auditu. I know that Luther was much more dependent upon Tauler the mystic than we often give him credit for. And it must be, I'm only guessing here, but it must be that, oh, I've heard monks talk this way, it must be that there are all kinds of sounds that come, even in silence. I mean, in silence you hear, you know, it's hardly ever that you're in a place where there's nothing that is in your ears or in your mind, where it's just empty silence. I don't know of a time like I would state like that. You're always kind of hearing something. You're re-listening to words that were spoken to you, or you've got some thoughts going, or it's never empty, but there's always content. It must be that what Luther developed was the ability to discern a certain kind of message, or to be able to, you know, to discern certain words that were being spoken, which were special words, even in silence, than all the other words. But that can go on. Yes.
Yeah, I'd like to just give some of my own experiences that I kind of reflect what you're saying, that at least from the secular or more secular world, that kind of maybe give some of the motivations for some of the changes. About 5-6 years ago, I was at a conference on environmentalism, but at a very scientific, very sophisticated scientific level, where there were a group of younger people who had not part of the environmental movement so much, but really trying to struggle in depth with dealing with these issues. And I remember one conversation we had, and how can you do that intensely in this society and still survive, and still, you know, as a person, and save your soul, not sell out? And what we came up with, the only thing we could say was, well, you get involved in the society for a period of time and then withdraw from it for recovery. That was the best thing that we could think of as the best way to do this, for kind of recuperation and a spiritual recuperation. But there were very few places to do this. I mean, a place like Holden maybe comes the closest. You know, just aren't that many. And since that time, I think we've seen the economic pressure, where people are forced into an either-or kind of situation. And I think this is current now, you either go along with the system or you're out of it. It seems to me that those choices are being forced more strongly now. It may be encouraging this kind of withdrawal, trying to find a place where you don't need that much of an income to survive. Because if you go the other way, there are just too many pressures on you. So I see a lot of these pressures from the secular world for people who are very conscientious, both about their inner peace and also action. And I'm not sure the answer is here yet.
Well, two things come to mind quickly. First, what I'm talking about here, I don't want to portray this as being something odd or unusual or kind of unique to my own point of view, because I don't believe that. And I know many of you share this, and if you were sitting up here, we could tell something of the same story. And the corroboration of that is large numbers of people who do this kind of thing on weekends. I taught last fall at Syracuse University, we had occasion to travel across country, you know, twice, and we took different routes. And we went to monasteries all on the way. In fact, I can't go to them anymore for a while because the main reason is they're all cloistered. And it's easy to get in if you're a man, but it's difficult with kids and impossible with a wife and kids kind of overnight. So I don't do that as much as I used to. But it's amazing how many people are there on Sundays and just hang around these places, who kind of come for the day. They drive hundreds of miles to be at Mount Xavier in Elmira on a Sunday morning. And then they'll take lunch there, and they'll be around the grounds, and they'll talk to the monks and smell the roses. And there's even a kind of lore that is developing, which isn't written down yet as far as I know, but it gets passed from person to person. You find out that the monastery in Weston Priory in Vermont is a very live place, but there are others like the Trappist Abbey of Genesee, New York, which is a little more negative. Elmira is a good one. Louisville is a sacred place, has to be, where Thomas Merton was. And you feel it when you come into the area. And all this information gets passed on Sundays among these families who kind of tell people where they ought to go. There's a dandy one down there in Lafayette, Oregon, which is really my favorite. And there are lots of people there on Sunday mornings. There's another one in the Big Sur area, a New Camaldoli Hermitage, which is very austere, about 8 miles south of Lucia, near Esalen on Highway 1, south of Monterey, if you're down that way. And that place is filled on Sundays. And I think the interest in that is growing. There's also a kind of byproduct that some of the monastic or the music developed in monasteries is being sung in the churches. That's happening more and more. Records are being sold. It takes the monks by surprise, however. They're not quite prepared to have this group of people come in and ask them questions about the spiritual life. The next thing I want to, the final thing I want to say in response to that is, I didn't ever get back to this, my friend Moltmann, who started this whole sequence with the theology of hope. I had stayed pretty close to his thought for those years up to, well, till recently. But I hadn't seen him since 1971. And in April 22nd of this past year, he was in, he's a German theologian, but he had come to St. Louis on invitation of Eden Theological Seminary. He had come there to give some lectures, but at the very time that he was celebrating his 50th birthday, and I was invited to attend this kind of birthday party, and all along the way, you know, from Los Angeles to St. Louis, I was rehearsing my speech. I thought, surely I've got to tell him that I'm no longer an advocate of this. I mean, I'm not an unqualified advocate of the theology of hope movement the way I might have been at one time. I thought I owed that to him. So I had this thing all kind of sorted out in my head. And when I got there, he was all friendly and everything, and I sat down. It was just the way I'd hoped. We were sitting on a Davenport together. And I started going through this chronicle and telling him how my mind had changed and what had happened to make my mind change. Before I could even get the thing done, he just put his hand on my knee like that. He says, "You don't have to proceed any further." He said, "I know what you're telling me." He said, "The title of my next book, which he's working on now, is called The Mysticism of the Cross." Now, which indicates that he himself has gone the whole route. I'm from theology of hope, from political theology, to a kind of mystical spirituality or spiritual mysticism or interior religion. He had followed the whole entire sequence. And what makes The Mysticism of the Cross the appropriate title for the next book is the intermediate book, which was entitled The Crucified God. He says that political theology led him to a recognition of the necessity of a crucifixion. And it's from the crucifixion that he began to think more about the interior life, and that led him into this mysticism of the cross.
Haven't we come full cycle?
I think so.
And there are cycles of that that occur. From the turn of the century until on into the middle 20s, there was great emphasis on the contemplative life. And students were encouraged in the YMCA and what church groups there were to observe the morning watch, and in conferences they got together for groups, and they were encouraged to find some place where early morning they could go off and meditate and reflect for themselves. And after World War I, we began to swing in more on action, and now we're probably coming back to a greater emphasis on retreat and disengagement. You referred to Hans Nielsen Hauge. Hauge was not a contemplative man only. I suppose that contemplation, prayer, and action were wedded in almost equal proportions in his life. And it seems to me that that's the New Testament direction.
And aren't they both together? Isn't that what we have to struggle with? It's like you need them both. And I see a lot of people searching for ways where they can be active in society and get their hope irrationally. Get their hope not because what they do is going to be successful, but they're going to do it anyway. But in order to do that, one of the reasons they may go to a commune or seek out something like this is financial. Because in order to do the action and have the freedom to do that, you cannot be too closely tied to the economic system. And so I see that a struggle that people are having is trying to have that contemplative and communal, small communal kind of activity along with the action. But it's very hard to get that balance.
Yeah, well, my final line would be the reference to the Taizé community, which has as its motto suffering and contemplation. I mean, again, the two side by side. We do have to stop here, though. Vespers are coming up at 8 o'clock. Thank you very much.
Thank you.